Well, all right. We'll just let him have fun somewhere else. We've been studying Exodus this quarter, having a great class on Sunday morning. Our young people are studying across the parking lot on Sunday morning as well, and this is all because they're preparing for EPIC. And so we've studied with them, and sermons primarily coming out of Exodus. Next Sunday, however, we'll have a little bit of a change and a treat. Denny Petrillo will be here with us from the Excel Still More workshop that's going to take place, planning to take place this week. And he is past director from the Bear Valley Bible Institute. Good friend, great teacher. Looking forward to him being here next Sunday. Don't know what he's going to preach on. But if it's Exodus, I might tell him maybe something else right now. We'll see. But Exodus is a fantastic study so far. I think I've really been enjoying it. I hope you have too. So why study Exodus? Because it's epic. All right, a little play on words there. Our young people are preparing for epic, but it is epic. When you think about Exodus, we've already talked about the fact that there's the birth of a nation is involved. God called Abraham when Abraham was, as the Hebrew writer put it, as good as dead, promised him a son and didn't give him a son for 25 years, and from that son comes a nation, actually 75 people who go down into Egypt in the days of Joseph. And from that 75 people, the entire nation arises. And the Exodus is them coming out of Egypt and being the nation on the move, God giving them a law. We've got a lot of ground to cover. We're not going to cover all that this morning, but I've got a few things I want to talk about as far as why it's great to study Exodus. Number one, Exodus shows us that the folks still believed in God. We talk about them being in Egyptian bondage for 400 years. And actually, they weren't in bondage for 400 years. They were in Egypt 400 years. The bondage would come a while after they got down there. But at any rate, it was horrible bondage, however long it was. But the people kept their faith in God. And the reason we know this is because we read about Shiphrah and Puah. Do you remember them? These wonderful ladies. And by the way, I couldn't help think about our own ladies yesterday having that wonderful gathering of young women from the congregations in this area, and what a great work that was. And I hope you're not too discouraged about the numbers. That's one thing I notice about the Bible. God never talks about the size of any particular congregation. It's always about the power, the strength of their faith. So don't let your heart be troubled over that. Just carry on. There's a place where Paul is talking about the resurrection. And he says, your labor in the Lord is not in vain. And of course, in that context, it's about the resurrection. But I think that's true for any effort we make on behalf of God. It's never in vain. It's always good. It's always worthwhile. And this is, by the way it sounds, the springboard for even more and better. I don't know about better, but more. We'll say it that way. So there's Shiphrah and Puah. These are the ladies who refused to kill the little babies, the boy babies that Pharaoh said, we got too many Israelites. You Hebrew midwives, I want you to start killing off the boy babies when they're born. And they said, we're not going to do that. And so they were women who feared the Lord, and God blessed them for that. We also read about the elders and the people in Exodus chapter 4, 29 to 31, how God said, you go call them and show them the signs that I have given you. This is how it turns out here. Exodus 4, verse 29, Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he performed the signs in the sight of the people. The signs we were talking about in class this morning. God gave Moses a staff. Actually, he already had a staff. He was a shepherd, and God said, throw it down. He threw it down. What happened to it? It became Mike's favorite animal, a snake. And he picked it up, and it became a staff again. And then put his hand in his bosom, and it became leprous when he pulled it out, put it back in, came out clean, took water, poured it out, and it became blood. So those were the signs that he was showing. And it says in verse 31, so the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed low and they worshiped. But that's not all. When we get to chapter 19, it just kind of throws it in there that there were priests among the people. Now, the law was not given yet, so these were not Levitical priests or Aaronic priests, but there were priests among the people. And you may remember when Moses fled into the wilderness, he met the daughters of the priest of Midian, whose name was Jethro or Reuel. Jethro might have been a title. At any rate, it wasn't a title on the Beverly Hillbillies. We know who Jethro was. That's how the name sticks with me. I don't know about you. It's kind of like, well, there's some other names like that, but we won't go into that because we got a few more things to talk about. But Exodus shows us that the people still retained faith in God to some degree. They had these women who refused to honor Pharaoh's order to kill the children. The men who saw Moses and Aaron and the signs that they performed believed, which didn't even happen all the time with Jesus, as you may recall, when he showed the signs that he did. And then there were those who were priests among them. So good evidence that they believed in God. It shows us, Exodus shows us, that God always does the unexpected. He spoke to Moses from a burning bush in the desert. By the way, where was that bush in the desert? It was on Sinai. It was on Sinai, and God would bring them back to this place later. It shows that God enlisted the help of an 80-year-old shepherd. Imagine your Pharaoh, the splendor of the Egyptian court. What we see down there right now are splendid things, but they are ruins. Imagine what that place must have been like in its heyday, and with Pharaoh in all his regalia and all his power, all his influence. And here comes an 80-year-old shepherd from the desert to say, "We want you to let all your slaves go." What would that be like? But that's the way God did it. He didn't send an army. Maybe you remember that story about the mother whose little boy came home from Bible class and said, "What did you learn in class today?" He said, "Oh, we learned all about how God saved the Israelites out of Egypt." Said they got their tanks and trucks all lined up and they headed out of Egypt and they got to the sea and the Egyptians were attacking. So they got their engineers and they built a pontoon bridge across the Red Sea and they escaped. And then they had their demolition guys rig explosives. And when the Egyptians tried to cross, they blew up the bridge. And all the Egyptians were killed in the river or in the sea. And his mother said, "Is that what they taught you in Bible class?" And he said, "Well, no, not really. But if I told you the way they told me, you wouldn't believe it." But that's the way God works. He always does things we would never expect. And he does it to make a point. Put faith in him. He saved households by the blood of being on doorposts and lintels. This is about the Passover. I hope to have a whole lesson devoted to the Passover, but this is a reference to it at this point, because who would have thought that this final plague on Egypt that would cause Pharaoh to let the people go would be one where the firstborn of every house would die, except in those houses marked by blood. And where'd that blood come from? Came from the lamb, the Passover lamb. Boy, there's so much imagery right there. But that's how God did it. He parted the sea. Can you imagine being an Israelite? You're leaving Egypt. Things are looking good. You look behind you and here comes Pharaoh and his army going to wipe you out. And there's no place to go. They were in a place where they were boxed in. They had no retreat. They had no army. Nothing looked like it was going to save them. And then God tells Moses, "How about we part that sea and you walk through on dry land?" And of course, God's pillar of fire came behind them and safeguarded them until they could get through. And that's how God did that. Who ever would have thought of that? Water from a rock happened twice. You're out in the desert. If you've ever been there, you know that place is pretty bleak. Water is a hard commodity to come by. But when these people, probably a minimum of 3 million people, were thirsty and their animals were thirsty, they cried out to Moses. Moses cried out to God. And from a rock came water. Who would have thought of that? And when they were hungry, how many McDonald's do you suppose there were along the way to the promised land? Not too many. But there was manna. You get up in the morning, you go outside, it's waiting for you on the ground. Pick it up and eat it. It's good. Good stuff. And when you get tired of manna, quail. They complain, "Oh, that's manna." Really? You complaining about food being on the ground when you get up in the morning? You just walk out and pick it up? You don't have to plant a crop. You don't have to harvest it. You don't have to weed it. How many of you remember as a kid having to hoe corn and thinking, I'd rather be anywhere else but hoeing corn? And they get up in the morning, walk outside, and there's manna on the ground. When they get tired of manna, God sends them quail. By the text, it sounds like they come in low enough that you can knock them down with a stick. Now, you talk to any bird hunters in here who ever hunted quail, that's a hard job hunting quail. And a covey will come up and you'll think you're going to shoot. I'll just shoot in the middle of them and I'll get one. And that's the best way to miss you've ever seen. You got to pick one. And they were coming in. That they were knocking them down and cooking them up and eating them till it was coming out their nostrils and they were sick of it. Who would have ever thought that out in the desert they would get water from a rock? Who would have ever thought they'd wake up and there'd be food on the ground in the form of manna? Who would have ever thought when they got tired of manna that there'd be so much quail they'd get sick of it? Who would have ever thought any of those things? Well, none of us. Think about that when it comes to your life and you get in this predicament and you don't know how you're going to get out of this or how it's going to be resolved. Talk to the Lord. He's got ways and means you can never, ever even imagine. So that's one of the things that Exodus teaches us. This question, who's the Lord? Mike mentioned this in class this morning. Who asked it initially? Pharaoh. Who is the Lord that I should listen to him? That's that reference to chapter 5 and verse 2. Well, it is answered several times in the text of Exodus. God says, you're going to know that I'm the Lord. And he tells Israel that. You're going to know that I am the Lord. And he says this in one way or another several different times. He says it for the Egyptians. The Egyptians, they're going to know that I'm the Lord when this is all over. He says it for Pharaoh. Pharaoh's going to know that I am the Lord. He says it for Pharaoh again. Pharaoh's going to know I'm the Lord when I get finished with him. Pharaoh, you're going to know this so well, you're going to be sick of knowing that I'm the Lord. Because God's going to make a point with him. Now he says it for Moses. He's saying to Moses, yeah, you're going to know that I'm the Lord after all these things have transpired, and you're going to be talking to your son and your grandson, your children, your downline. That's what God tells Moses. Tells the Egyptians again, they're going to know that I am the Lord. Egyptians, one more time, they're going to know I'm the Lord. And then finally, Israel. Israel will know that I am the Lord. This is why so much of the account in Numbers and in Deuteronomy of the people losing faith with God stuns me. I read that, how can it be? After all that they saw, and all the times and all the ways that God proved to them that he was in fact the Lord, they still lost faith. And this is a lesson for me. Don't ever lose faith. Don't ever lose faith. Don't ever get away from the fellowship that God offers through his son Jesus. Don't ever get away from the fellowship of the saints. Don't ever leave the things that remind you that God is in control. Because in this world, it seems like things get crazy and out of hand. And we might wonder, where is God? All you got to do is watch the news. And you'll wonder, where is the Lord? Have you ever asked yourself, how much longer is he going to wait? How can he not just send lightning bolts down left and right all over the place? I used to think about that and kind of wonder, I wish he'd do that. And then I think, well, what about me? What about me when I do stuff I shouldn't do? I might have a lightning bolt with my name on it if I'm not careful. God is going to let us know always that he is the Lord. What did David say? The heavens declare his glory and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech. Paul would say the same thing in Romans chapter 1. That those who say there is no God are without excuse because of all of the creation declaring it to them on a daily basis. So, the question, who is the Lord, is answered in Exodus. God makes a distinction between his people and others. This is made clear when he's sending out the plagues and they fall on the Egyptians, but they don't fall on the Israelites. This is from chapter 11, verse 7. Ezekiel chapter 9, if you want to look at Ezekiel, this is an interesting text. The nation's gone through a lot of history by the time we get to Ezekiel. And they've gotten to a point where they have become faithless and idolatrous. And God is so displeased with them that he sends them into Babylonian captivity. But he shows what he does before he sends them into captivity. This is Exodus chapter 9, verse 1. He cried out in my hearing, Ezekiel said, and with a loud voice saying, draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. Behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate which faces north, each with his shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen with a writing case at his loins. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Where's the bronze altar? That's in the temple. Then the glory of the Lord of Israel went up from the cherub on which it had been to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed in linen at whose loins was the writing case. And this is what he said. Go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. A lot of sinfulness was taking place in Jerusalem, a lot of iniquity. That's a good Bible word, isn't it? A lot of abomination was happening in Jerusalem. God said, I'm not putting up with it anymore. But I'm not just going to wipe out everybody. He sends this one angel to mark everyone who groans over Israel's sinfulness. Now, this was a vision. It wasn't literal. God is showing us through the prophet that he knows who his faithful ones are. And so he shows this vision of them being marked by this one before the destruction begins. To the others, he says in verse 5, go through the city after him and strike. Do not let your eye have pity and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, women, but do not touch any man on whom is the mark. And you shall start from my sanctuary. So they started with the elders who were before the temple. If this passage doesn't get your attention, I don't know what will. But God makes a distinction between his people and others. He did that in Exodus, and he continually does that. And he does it in the Revelation. We see another vision that John gets in the Revelation of those who are God's being marked in their foreheads. In other words, God is letting us know nobody's going to slip through the cracks. If you're being oppressed by the Romans, you're thrown in prison, you think everybody's forgotten you, well, I haven't forgotten you. You're mine. And it's just as all of Israel was in bondage in Egypt, they might have thought that God forgot them, but he never did. He made a distinction between them, between the Egyptians. He makes a distinction between you and me and everyone else in the world. And our work, our job, is to so preach Christ that the number of those who do not have the mark would continually decrease, that they might be coming into the fold of Christ and being marked in their foreheads as well. Was there not another one? Oh, that's it. Okay. The Passover lamb. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but because I want to do an entire lesson on the Passover. But first of all, its blood meant safety. The instructions were to take that lamb. By the way, you'd take that lamb on the 10th day of the month, but you wouldn't kill it until the 14th. So you've got that little lamb in your house with your family for all that time. What's going to happen to you and that little lamb? I imagine you're going to be pretty close to that. It's hard not to love a lamb, a little baby animal of any kind, even kittens. You got to love kittens. How can you not love a kitten? How can you not want to pick them up and hold them and pet them? I hope I don't sound silly. I hope I sound relatable, because I think everybody feels that way about babies, even baby horses, baby cows. They're cute. Cows are dumb. But calves are cute. I think everybody would agree with that. But you take this little lamb and you keep it with your family for those days. And then on the evening of the 14th, you'd kill it. And you know how animals were killed in that time. You had to use a weapon by hand, not a gun, not something you did for at a distance. You'd take a knife and you would kill it and you would use its blood. And that blood would be put on the doorposts and on the lintels of the house. No bone was to be broken of that lamb. They would eat it. They would eat it whole. Not a single bone was broken, because it was looking forward to Jesus' crucifixion. And all of this Passover is based in the fact that Jesus is eventually going to be sacrificed for us. Don't ever think that the sacrifice of Christ was based in the Passover. It's the other way around. God gave them the Passover because he knew what was coming, and he wanted to give us an image, give them an image and give us an image of what he was going to do to save us from sin and from bondage. We see the law introduced in the Exodus in chapter 20. God begins to give Moses the law, and we know that the law is how we have our knowledge of sin. This is a point that Paul makes in Romans chapter 3. And the more I study the Bible, you know, when I was younger, I thought, oh, by the time I'm this age that I am now, I'll probably have things pretty well lined out. But the longer I live, the more I study, and the more I study, the more I find out I'm not fit. I'm not fit to be before the Lord. I always feel like Isaiah, when Isaiah found himself before the throne of God in chapter 6. Woe is me. Why, Isaiah? Why? Woe, you're before the throne of God. He says, yes, I'm before the throne of God, but I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. We can't do enough to get right. We are desperately in need of a Savior. And the law is what shows us how desperately we need a Savior. And that was given on Sinai through Moses to the people of Israel. And then Paul writes in the letter to the churches of Galatia that the law was our schoolmaster to lead us to Christ. You're learning and you're learning and you're learning from the law, but what are you learning? You're learning you can't get right. You can't make yourself right. You need a Savior, and that Savior is Christ. And the law was our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. And then we realize that the entire Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, all that was given to Moses during the period of the Exodus. And all of the narratives, when you read the accounts of what took place in Numbers and in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus, you're reading things that took place during the period of the Exodus. It's all focused in that time of history. We learn that faithlessness leads to ruin. That text that Micah read so well for us a little while ago, that was all about the Exodus and what the people of Israel did during the Exodus in disobeying God, in losing faith in God, in rebelling against God. And so Paul was using, the Holy Spirit inspired him, use Exodus, Paul, right here when you're writing to these saints at Corinth to warn them against losing faith. That's what that was all about. Faithlessness leads to ruin. If you check out Numbers chapter 1, verses 45 to 46, you'll read that there were 603,550 who left Egypt. But how does that number qualify? Or how is it qualified? That's only the number of fighting men who were 20 years old and upwards who could bear the sword. That's how many fighting men they had. If there were 605,550 fighting men, how many actual Israelites do you suppose there were altogether? You can do some math, but there's not a number given for that total number. We're just told the number of fighting men. We have to figure a few things out from that. Well, 603,550 left Egypt. How many of those crossed into the Jordan, or crossed the Jordan into the Promised Land? Just those two. So once again, ladies, when you're thinking numbers matter, numbers don't matter. Faithfulness matters. That's what matters to God. How many were saved on the ark? Eight. How many people were in the world? We don't know, but there was a lot more than eight. But the only place to be safe was on that ark, and there were only eight. God is worried, not worried, he's concerned. He holds in regard faithfulness rather than anything else. Number eight. You know what they did while they were in the wilderness? They put together the tabernacle. And they did it all according to the pattern that God showed them. What was the tabernacle? Tabernacle is a word that means tent. It's a temporary structure. God gave them all of the parts. He said, this is how I want you to build these curtains, and this is how I want you to build this piece of furniture. Here's how I want you to make all of the utensils that you'll use for the sacrifices and for the altar. Everything was spelled out in great detail, and all along the way, God was telling Moses, I want you to make this according to the pattern. Don't just make it any way you want. Don't use your imagination. Make it according to the pattern. Do it the way I'm telling you to do it. Because the tabernacle was foreshadowing the church. God knew what the church was supposed to be like, and he wanted the tabernacle to be a type of that, a picture of that, a shadow of that, if you will, as the Hebrew writer puts it. He talks about all of these things as being shadows of the reality that was to come, and the reality that was to come is the church. You are in, if you are in the Lord's church, if you're a member of the church, you are in the reality that the tabernacle was representing. We might read Exodus and think, wow, that was really important to be in the tabernacle, to have the tabernacle, to put it all together. The tabernacle was what God was giving them and now showing us to show us what the kingdom was supposed to be like. It's all based on the kingdom. So we've got that that's supposed to be built according to the pattern. It's mentioned seven times in the text of Exodus. There's that goofy animation. I'm going to have to quit using that because I tap it and then I have to wait till it gets done before I can read it. The glory of God filled it. Look at Exodus chapter 40. This is the last thing we read in Exodus as the book is closing. This is what God had Moses to write down as the end of what we call Exodus. They built everything according to the pattern. And then in chapter 40, verse 34 says this. The cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Now that's interesting too, because you may recall God was on top of Mount Sinai and he was calling Moses up there. And Moses would go up there into the cloud with all the thunderings and the fire and the lightnings and all that that scared the dickens. I don't know what a dickens is, but I guess you can get it scared out of you. But scared the dickens out of the Israelites. And they, oh, we don't want the, oh, don't, that's too loud and too scary. But Moses was up there in that for 40 days. But in this case, when God's glory fills the tabernacle that they had built according to the pattern, Moses couldn't even go in. Throughout all their journeys, wherever the cloud was taken up, or whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the sons of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day it was taken up. For throughout all their journeys, the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and there was fire in it by night in the sight of all the house of Israel. Imagine the camp. Every tribe arranged around the tabernacle. In the daytime, you'd see that cloud over the tabernacle. At nighttime, you'd see the pillar of fire over the tabernacle. And when the cloud would raise up, oh, it's time to move. Let's get our stuff packed up. God's going to take us somewhere else. But that was all centered, all focused over the tabernacle. God's dwelling place, if you will, with men. He didn't live in it. He's in the heavenlies. He didn't live in temples made with hands. But it represented his presence with the Israelites. And now today, according to what Paul wrote in the letter to the Ephesian church and also the Corinthian church as well, we are God's temple. The Spirit of God lives in you today. Exodus really is epic, not just a play on words. Fantastic story of God leading his people out of bondage. And they fulfilled the name Israel, he who struggles with God, because they struggled with God throughout the wilderness. And as Micah read for us a little while ago, he let their carcasses fall in the wilderness because they were faithless. But those who were faithful, even if it was just two, I want you to see yourself in Joshua. I want you to see yourself in Caleb. I want you to see yourself going through the wilderness, making it through the wilderness and crossing into the promised land when it's all over. Because this whole story, this whole account, this whole record is like a microcosm of you and me. We're in bondage to sin. Christ sets us free through his blood, the Passover lamb. We flee the wickedness of sin and evil, but we are still in the wilderness. And as we learned in our class this morning, it's not easy. But by faith, we push on, we persevere. And at the end, there will be the reward. I don't know what it was like for Joshua and Caleb as they watched the priests step into the Jordan River with the Ark of the Covenant and the waters parted again, just like they parted at the Red Sea. Those two guys saw that. They saw the waters part at the Red Sea, and now they're seeing the sea part at Jordan. You and I are going to see some things when our lives come to an end. It's going to be marvelous. It's going to be fascinating. It's going to be unbelievable, unimaginable. But all that is pictured for us in Exodus. So it's a good thing for us to study this book. Well, where are you? Are you part of Israel? Are you part of the church? Are you part of the family of God? Are you set apart and is God making a distinction between you and the lost folks of this world? Are you ready to join hands with Moses and lift up your heart and mind to God? Do you need the prayers of this congregation? Whatever you need this morning, we'd like to help you. We want you to make it through the wilderness. We want you to make it to the promised land. So let's stand and sing for anybody who might need our